Okay, so, the topic is lodges this time, and, since we are not really involved in Satanism, I'm hoping the lecture doesn't fall over like it did last time. The whole topic of lodges and the position that the Lutheran Church at Missouri Synod has taken on them is a very unpopular one. And for that reason, we feel compelled to defend the position that the Lutheran Church has taken. I should say the Lutheran Church, because it's more than the Missouri Synod involved. The other Lutheran churches have also taken a position, as have many others. And I will mention these as we go along. Sometimes people think it's a peculiarly Lutheran position, but it isn't. Moody Monthly, a couple of months ago, put out a catalog of cults. And in there they had all the various ones that have been spoken of so far during this workshop. And among them they included the Masonic Lodge. And that caused quite a reaction. The letters were unbelievable that came into Moody Monthly. They are now trying to defend their position, and I just have been invited to submit an article to them concerning the Masonic Lodge. So we'll see what's going to happen there. But let's start with this general thing that somewhere here in America, somebody wants you. They want you for a member of their organization. And as regardless of what your hobby is, your vocation, there's a club somewhere that's organized for people just like you. These clubs have just proliferated to where it takes a whole library just to have a master file on them. And some of the clubs are very large, which have millions of members. Some are very small. But whether you're a guppy breeder, or a stamp collector, or a public accountant, or interested in hang gliding, or whatever it is, somewhere there's a club that wants you for a member. Some of these have some very exotic names. Some aren't so exotic. On the exotic, you would have the International Concatenated Order of Hoo-Hoo. This is the official title, the Society of People Who Think That Historians Have Libeled Aaron Burr. There's the Prudent Patricians of Pompeii. And then there are the ordinary ones like the elks, eagles, owls, moose, beavers, buffaloes, bears, deer, and white rabbits. There are organizations for soap sculptures, euthanasia enthusiasts, simple spellers, left-handed golfers, African violet growers, trailer owners, tall people, homing pigeon racers, and people who formerly pumped pipe organs. There's organizations like TOPS for people who want to take off pounds sensibly, and there's the American Sunbathers Association for people who just want to take off. We in America are appalled sometimes when we pick up National Geographic magazine and we see a picture taken somewhere in Africa of a tribe of people gathered around munching on their ancestors' bones, hoping that thereby they can absorb some of the wisdom and strength of their ancestors. But this is nothing compared with some of the initiation rites of some of America's more civilized organizations, particularly the ancient Arabic order of the nobles of the mystic shrine, the Shriners. Their initiation defies description. That's where you must urinate on the devil's pass in order to get by and all sorts of things. Most of these organizations, of course, are purely for fun, but sometimes they're also quite serious. Some are even subversive of public good, like the Cosa Nostra. But there are civic service organizations, social, political, labor, professional, campus, veterans, sports, temperance, racist, religious, youth organizations, insurance organizations, criminal, hobby, and revolutionary organizations, just to mention a few of the categories. And with the most of these, you will find there is nothing incompatible at all with the Christian faith. Yes, why are Americans joiners? Well, in a survey that we took, we found, of people who have joined clubs, we found that for a great many of them, for the largest number, it's a search for some kind of identity. to be with people of their own kind. Let's take George, whose Excedrin headache number 76 is that when he comes home, his wife says, "Look, you're still just a clerk in that store. You're never going to amount to anything. In all your life, you're going to be nothing more than a clerk, and you're going to bring home that same paycheck all the time." And George hears this 6 days a week from his wife. "You haven't gotten a raise, you haven't gotten a promotion." But on the seventh day of the week, he goes down to the lodge. And there he is, the grand imperial potentate, and anybody who passes his chair has to bow as they go by. And George has an identity that he wouldn't surrender for anything in the world, because he is recognized there for what he believes is his true worth. And so this gives him more stature than anything else in life. Another girl, she's in a secretary pool with 20 other girls. They all have the same typewriters, same desks, and probably all the same hairdo, for all I know. But there they are. But she is the representative of that group to the National Association of Secretaries. And they all have to come to her and pay their dues. She distributes the literature from the association. She's the one in that office of 20 girls that has an identity. The rest all just kind of blend together. So that's one of the first reasons given. The second is for business advantages. And in spite of the fact that even in the Masonic Lodge, before you enter the room for initiation, you must take a pledge in the anteroom to the effect that you are not joining for business purposes, you'll find that a great many Masons whom you interview will tell you that they joined for business purposes. And the same can be true of some of the other lodges. Another is service opportunities. People join because they find a way of serving their community, their fellow man, through the organization. You look at the Shriners Crippled Children's Hospitals, there is no finer kind of hospital in the world. There is none where people give so much of themselves as the Shriners when they go out and visit with these kids. Not only contributing to the maintaining of the hospital, but they give of themselves. And they are serving their community. And I don't know if you're acquainted with the rules that if you can afford it, that you're not allowed in the Shriners hospitals. It's only for those who can't afford it. If you can't afford it, they ask you to get your help somewhere else. So you have a very noble humanitarian effort here, and people do join for that reason. Then there are others for group protection. Some groups offer life or health insurance. Some provide orphanages or homes for the aged. Some groups feature studies, particularly those that gather around some avocation of some sort. You can come together and study about growing flowers or this or that. Some are cultural, maybe the Danish Brotherhood, see, or something like this, where people share a common culture and they want to simply enjoy that culture together. Some are exclusive, they have a certain snob appeal. They're the one place in town where only the best people can belong, the Society of Cincinnati or something like this. Some join for the pageantry. Every grown man, and since we have one lady present, every grown lady, too, has a lot of little boy or little girl left in them. And the society may offer them a chance to wear a sword. Everybody, every man would like to wear a sword sometime. Here he can do it without being ridiculed because that's part of the group. And so it's the pageantry. You can wear a cocked hat if you want, and nobody's going to think you're weird because they all have cocked hats on, or an evening dress. It gives you the one chance in a small community in the Midwest. The only chance a woman has to wear an evening dress is by being a member of a certain group. Some for power. We think of the Ku Klux Klans, even the John Birch Society and some of the others, that people want to be part of a power group, but they also have a chance to remain anonymous, particularly the Ku Klux Klans. Some just for religiosity. They're not members of any church. They really make no confession of a religious creed, but in the flowery ritual, they get a good feeling of religiosity. And they sometimes mistake this then for religious commitment. Now you have all these kinds of organizations, and as mentioned, for the most part, a Christian can belong to most of these with no problem. But somewhere along the line, he's liable to encounter a problem, and that is when this group to which he belongs starts to make religious pronouncements. When it begins to make definitive statements concerning God, or the nature of man, or the plan of man's salvation, or something of this nature, then the Christian is going to have to rock back on his heels and start asking some questions and say, can I support this group? Can I support it financially and thereby contribute to its spread? Can I identify with the confession that is the official confession of this group? These are questions he must begin to ask. And this is the first thing that we as a church would do, is ask people to look into what they're identifying themselves with, because the identity is made once they have joined. Now, also the doctrine of Scripture. How does this group treat the Bible? So there are four questions that should always be asked: the doctrine of Scripture, the doctrine of God, the doctrine of man, and the doctrine of salvation. There are four other areas that are sometimes singled out as objectionable, and I'd like to lay them to rest. One of them is the oaths. Too often, especially our Lutheran people, when they're asked why is the church opposed to the lodge, will say because it has oaths. There's nothing wrong with oaths. There's nothing wrong with calling upon God as witness to what you say, per se. It's the content of the oath, but now the content of the oath is quite different than the idea of taking an oath, see? And if that content is hidden from you, and you call upon God as a witness that you're going to support it, then the oath is wrong, regardless of whether it is to do good or not. The book of Leviticus makes that quite clear when it points out that if a man swear to do something and it be hidden from him, then shall he bear his judgment. He's calling upon God as a witness that he's going to do something, perform something, and he doesn't even know what it is. And Leviticus speaks quite harshly of that. Now, granted, most people who join the lodges can't even remember the oaths. They didn't even register when they were taken. And they say, oh, that's a lot of Mickey Mouse stuff. It's just a form you go through. That's all. Just a form you have to go through. I think Robert Bolt, in his introduction to the book A Man of All Seasons, or A Man for All Seasons, that was made into a play also, tells us something about oaths. He's not writing from a religious viewpoint. He has no chip on his shoulder. And in that introduction, he says this. He says, an oath on the part of a Christian is an invitation to God, an invitation that God will not refuse, to act as witness and judge. A man takes an oath only when he wants to commit himself quite exceptionally to a statement, when he makes the identity between the truth of his statement and his own virtue. He offers himself as a guarantee. So oaths are not to be taken lightly. And so just the fact that an oath is taken in itself is not wrong. It's the content, the circumstances. The second reason people say we object to the lodges is because they have a ritual. So what? We use a ritual every Sunday morning in our church. It's either on page 5 or page 15 or maybe page 41 or something of the hymnal, but it's as much of a ritual as anything you can find. There's nothing wrong with having a ritual. It's the content of the ritual that must, in some cases, be objected against. Then the third one is, they say, well, they're secret organizations. That's why we're opposed to them. They're not secret organizations. The only secret organizations I know of are some like the Ku Klux Klan. That's the secret organization. People hide their identity. They don't want it to be known that they're a member. They wear a mask so that they can remain anonymous. But the lodges are not secret. People let it be known openly. There are organizations that have secrets. but they're not secret organizations. And there's a distinction. I wish the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod had a few more secrets.
Yes, and then in Mississippi, I know some of their marches down there, a lot of them didn't have emails.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of them don't any longer, but at one time they were very secretive, and you can't get membership lists anyway, even if they do show themselves. I know certain things about me. I'm glad you don't know about me. See? All of us have secrets. There's nothing wrong with having secrets. If an organization wants to keep its affairs confidential, well and good. But secrecy becomes wrong when, as mentioned, it's coupled together with an oath to uphold it, and it's still a secret at the time the oath is taken. And then the final one, that people say, well, they have a closed membership. They won't let everybody join. There's nothing wrong with that either. Here you've got a club of African violet growers, and a bunch of daisy growers come along, and they want to join. And they say, hey, wait a minute, you can't belong to this. You have to be interested in African violets if you want to belong to this club. Because they know what happens. When the daisy growers outnumber the African violet growers, they're going to spend all their time talking about daisies, and that's not what the club was for. It was for African violets, see? So there's nothing wrong with having a closed membership, saying that only members of, only graduates from this college can be members of the Alumni Association. See? Nothing wrong with that. But closed membership can be wrong when the organization says, we accept all men. We stand for brotherhood of man. But sorry, no blacks allowed. See? That's the kind of closed membership that becomes wrong. Because it is contradictory within itself. Brotherhood, but no blacks. See? Or like the Elks, who by law were forced because they rent some property from, you know, that is owned by the government. I think in the Millbrook division here in St. Area here in St. Louis, the Elks have a...
It's down on 20th and Market.
Yeah, they...
But it's no longer the Elks Club now.
Is that right? But at one time, you know, they rented from the government there. And because this takes place in other places, too, the government forced them to drop their whites-only clause. So very magnanimously, the Elks dropped their whites-only clause. With the notation that when the day comes that the government allows private organizations to establish their own membership standards, when that day comes, the whites-only clause will be reinserted into the Constitution without any convention action being necessary. It's automatic. The minute the government takes the pressure off, the whites-only clause goes right back in automatically with no action. So, was this really... an extension of brotherhood to drop it originally? I mean, I keep hearing this from members of the Elks Club or from officials of the Elks Club. Oh, we knocked that out a long time ago. They didn't knock it out a long time ago. They're still just as whites-only as they ever were, but the government says right now you can't get by with it. That's all. In that case, closed membership. Now, they said we stand for limited brotherhood. We don't believe in the brotherhood of all men. Then they can have their closed membership. See? But when they say we stand for the highest ideals of brotherhood, then closed membership on such a basis becomes objectionable. Okay? Yes, yes. They were forced into this, though, because of the... It was started by Prince Hall, who was a free man. And it was chartered by a lodge in England, which makes it a legitimate lodge, although here in this country they will not accept it. The question was whether the blacks have their own Elks Lodge, or their own Masonic organization. They also have their own Elks, the improved order of Elks.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
The white Masons are ancient, except the ancient.
Yeah.
But the black Masons are free, except the Masons.
Yeah.
They have them.
Right.
The age separates the two.
But it's been a rankling problem to the white Masons, the fact that this was legitimately commissioned, this lodge.
But in some parts of the East, they have broken everything down.
But you know, back about 1960, in the 1960s, Massachusetts, I think, was the first Grand Lodge of white Masons to admit black members. When that happened, two of the adjoining states withdrew recognition, and Texas withdrew recognition from Massachusetts, which meant that you couldn't, a Mason from Texas would not be allowed to visit a Massachusetts lodge. Or a Massachusetts Mason wouldn't be allowed to recognize Texas lodge because of the withdrawal of recognition. You can't transfer anything. See, the Masons have a chart with all the lodges on one side and the same ones across. And then where the squares meet, they have a black dot to show whether they recognize each other or not. Most of the time, the thing is solid black, that all the state lodges recognize each other. But every once in a while, something happens like Massachusetts admitting some blacks, and some of them withdraw recognition. So Massachusetts at that time did the noble thing. They put the two fellows out of the lodge. And then immediately recognition was reinstated. So you see, closed membership can become a problem if it conflicts with the very principles. I have one book put out by the Masonic Research Society which explains why blacks were not allowed. That they were Freemasons, and the blacks were not free. And then somebody objected, well, they're free today. And he said, no, the white people of America are keeping the blacks in economic bondage. And because they're in economic bondage, they're not free men. Therefore, we would like to have them, but unfortunately, we can't take them in because our rules say you have to be a free man. Enough on that. But anyway, I've tried to identify what the areas of concern are and what the areas are not. And let's see, I have that amendment here, yeah, of the Elks. It reads this way: this amendment, you're striking the Whites Only Clause, shall be effective only until the Supreme Court of the United States shall decide the right of the people to form associations and determine membership qualifications. That this right shall not be abridged, limited, or denied. And in the event of a favorable decision by the Supreme Court of the United States or the final adoption of a constitutional amendment that guarantees that the right of organizations shall not be abridged, that in the event of a favorable ruling, this amendment, striking the Whites Only Clause, shall be null and void and of no force and effect, and the language of the original article shall be reinstated and thereupon be in full force and effect. See, it's automatic. So now, one of the problems we run into in our church is that with the so-called animal lodges, and this is not a derogatory term. I mean, the Elks, Moose, and Eagles refer to themselves as the animal lodges, is the question of social memberships, where people are accepted into the lodge without initiation, without subscribing to anything. This is not tolerated by any of the three. It is strictly forbidden, so much so that if a local lodge takes in a member without initiation, it can lose its charter and its right to call itself by the name of the lodge. This is a contract that is made between a local lodge when it's chartered and the national body. Yet it is done in thousands of lodges in the Midwest. The headquarters refuse to recognize this because to recognize it would be to admit that they are unable to police their own ranks any longer. They're also quite rankled by this because no local lodge is going to admit it to the headquarters. They might lose their charters. Some have, in court, have lost their charters over this. So what they do is they take in the social members, but they don't remit their portion of the dues to the national because that would give them away. So the national is losing out on a lot of money from these social members. And that also causes some antagonism between the national and the local bodies. But nevertheless, it is being done. It is strictly not permitted. And that causes more of a problem than anything else. I'd like to read just here and there some excerpts from rituals, and these are things that people have subscribed to under oath with God as a witness. First of all, the Moose, the memorial service, which is mandatory. It must be held at every Moose Lodge every year, and all Moose are bound to attend. There's no punishment if they don't, but they're bound to attend. It's a memorial for those of the lodge who have died during the previous year. And this announcement then is made. There is indeed victory and triumph in surrender to the inevitable, in a brave and peaceful welcome to the hour of the soul's passing. To the coward, the life beyond is dread and dark. To the brave, it is cheering and luminous. It is not sacrifice, it is reward. Not a halting and stillness, but progress and thrilling clairvoyance. There is a solemnity, yea, sadness, in all our earthly partings, but do not despair. When in good time our scroll is written and the record of our achievement is made up, let us meet death with a level gaze. Upon the faces of the great and good, there shines a light reflected from the golden hills of heaven, which death cannot efface or dim. And for such, for all eternity, for the great and good, for all eternity, there awaits a peer's place in the seats of the mighty. This is a pronouncement. All moose, for all of them, there awaits a place in the seats of the mighty in capitalized form. From the first great work of the Masonic Lodge, the lamb has in all ages been deemed an emblem of innocence. He, therefore, who wears the lambskin as the badge of a Freemason, is constantly reminded of that purity of life and conduct which is so essentially necessary to his gaining admission into the celestial lodge above, where the supreme architect of the universe presides. The Elks mandatory memorial service. They call the roll of those who died, and nobody answers, see? They call their names, and there's no answer. This is to focus attention on the ones who died, and then the pronouncement is made. As Elks, we are taught that someday this mortal must put on immortality. Firm in our faith, we're reminded by these services that we are born not to die, but to live. True, the light of beloved eyes has faded from our sight, but it shines more brightly upon another shore. The voices we love to hear at the fireside, in marts of trade, in fraternal association, are silenced. But they will live again in the music of the choir invisible, and blend forever with the harmony of angels. Memorial Day is with us a day of tender sentiment. Hope dries our tears, and with the eyes of faith, we may see those whom we loved and lost for a while faring on to a better land, awaiting the day when the chain of fraternal love shall be reunited forevermore. Regardless of what their confession of faith, what their religion was, it's taken for granted. If you're a member of the Elks, that defending circle that you were taken from on earth will be reformed in heaven until the whole defending circle is there once more. And you can just go on and on with these pronouncements. Okay, so most people regard this Mickey Mouse stuff. Most people say these are forms you just have to go through. But the question still stands before us all the time, can the Christian before God call upon him to witness these things when he's only doing it as a form to go through? Can he give his aid and support to this philosophy? Can he blunt his Christian witness because he's not allowed to speak of his faith in the lodge? He's allowed to speak of faith, of religious things, but not his faith, not the Lord Jesus Christ in the lodge. Can he give the appearance of religion, robbed of Jesus Christ? And I think these are questions that almost put these lodges into the category of the cults, because they teach a way of salvation that is definitely outside of Jesus Christ. Sure, Freemasonry will tell you we have Christian degrees. The Rose Croix degree, the 18th degree of the Scottish Rite, is a Christian degree. But the great historian of the Scottish Rite, a man by the name of Baynard, who wrote the official history of the Scottish Rite, says, in this degree, Jesus is frequently alluded to as our Grand Master of Nazareth, just as we refer to Solomon and Hiram as our Grand Masters of Israel and Tyre. But never once in this whole degree do we find mention of the word Christ, nor the thought of Jesus Christ as the Son of God, or part of the Godhead. There are other statements where he points, with the Royal Arch degree, which is of the other branch of Masonry, the York Rite, or the American Rite, where it's pointed out that we are so broad in our charity toward people that we will accept those who believed more about Jesus Christ than he believed about himself, namely that he is the Son of God. In our charity, we'll accept you even if you believe he's the Son of God, although he himself never believed that. So I question whether you can, by any stretch of the imagination, call the Christian degrees Christian. There is so much material we could go through on this. I think I mentioned before the contract that is made between the local lodge and the headquarters in order to get a charter, but there's also a contract. It's an implied contract, but a contract nevertheless, made between the lodge and the person who joins. And we have tried to get the lodges to discuss this with us. We meet with the officials of the lodges sometimes. We've had some, not major organizations, but some smaller organizations say, we understand your concerns and we're going to make changes. Beta Sigma Phi, the adult women's sorority. So we never thought of it that way. You're right. We are making religious pronouncements. We'll take them out. Even the Boy Scouts made tremendous changes. Go back and look at a handbook from Boy Scouts back in the 30s and compare it with the modern day handbook. And you'll see how many changes they made at the request of our church body. Because they said, hey, you have some validity in what you're doing and what your concerns are. But with the lodges, we haven't gotten that kind of reception. And this implied contract with the individual is this, that before he enters into the room for initiation, the pledge is made to him, nothing will be required of you that will in any way conflict with your religious or political opinions. Then he goes in. Now, all of a sudden, he's required to subscribe to something that conflicts with his religious opinions. Now, what happens? He stops and he says, hey, wait a minute. You told me there would be nothing that subscribes with my religious opinions, and yet this does. Nothing conflicts. This does. So you got to take this out. You can't require it of me. Our question is always, what kind of answer do you give the man? To me, the only honest answer would be, look, this is our ritual, we're bound by this, everybody takes the same ritual. If this conflicts with your religious opinions, you would be better off not joining us, because that's what we stand for. That would be an honest answer. Or, outside there, we made this promise to you. We didn't realize that this particular thing conflicts, but because we made this promise to you, this pledge to you, we'll delete this part, and we won't require it of you, since it's a matter of conscience with you. That would be an honest answer. But there's only one answer that's given, and that is, we said this doesn't conflict, therefore it doesn't. That's the only answer that's given. We said it doesn't conflict, therefore it doesn't. And in that case, the lodge presumes to become the conscience of the individual. They're not granting him the right of his own conscience anymore. They're making the decision. We said it doesn't conflict, even if you think it does. Even if there's a conflict in your mind, it can't be, because we said it doesn't. And we have never gotten past this point in any of our discussions with national officials. We cannot get an answer to how do you honestly resolve this pledge that you made. I think if they would honor the pledge, we'd have no problem with the lodge. But that's where we're hung up. And but I think the big thing is that the spirit is so different. There is such a difference of spirit. You're sitting down and you're talking to people who can't comprehend what your religious conviction is. They simply, it's like talking to a stone wall. Not because they're obstinate, but because it's completely out of their frame of reference. I'll give you a sample of that. When we met with the officials of the Moose Lodge at Aurora, Illinois, at Moose Heart, there was a whole table full of officials, and one of the professors from the seminary here and I were sitting there, and they said, all right, give us an example of one thing you object to about the Moose Lodge. And I was new at this. And I said, I touched the most sacred thing of all. And I said, the 9 o'clock ceremony. And that is the most sacred thing in Moose stuff. Because at the 9 o'clock ceremony, this beautiful orphanage, which is, I think, the greatest orphanage that has ever existed in the world, up at Moose Heart. At 9 o'clock, the children kneel by their bedsides for their evening prayers. And wherever Moose are meeting, whether it's a social gathering or a lodge meeting, at 9 o'clock, all activity halts. And the Moose sing the song about Moose Heart, and then say together, God bless Moose Heart, while these children are praying, and then they go on again with their activities. But the song is based on the words, suffer the little children to come unto me. And those are the words that are inscribed on the entrance to the chapel at Moose Heart. The dedication folder for the chapel says that it is symbolic of the belief of the Moose that these little children will all be received into heaven regardless of what shades and grades of religious conviction they might have. That it symbolizes universalism. That's what the chapel is there for, to show that all people really believe the same, regardless of their individual differences. And so I said, now the only thing about the 9 o'clock ceremony, that's right, they chant it. They say, suffer the little children to come unto me, and then God bless Moose Heart. And I said, I have only one question, who is me? Suffer the little children to come unto me. And I said, it strikes me that the me there is Moose Heart. In the song, it looks like Moose Heart, suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of God. It means Moose Heart. And I said, that passage means Jesus Christ. And Carl Weiss, I believe his first name is Carl, anyway, it's Weiss, was the international treasurer at that time. And he jumped up and he said, if that means Jesus Christ, I must leave the Moose Lodge. You see, he's a Jew by faith and by nationality. He said, if suffer little children come unto me, of such is the kingdom of God, if that means Jesus Christ, I must leave the Moose. That's an old Hebrew proverb that Jesus simply assumed to himself. But it's part of the heritage of literature, an old Hebrew proverb. That's what I mean by you're talking from a different spirit, see? You're coming from such different directions that you simply can't get through to these people what real Christian concern is.
And
this was back in the 60s. No, because the rest of them all approved. No, this does not refer to Jesus Christ. So then he was comfortable. But, when I said the 9 o'clock ceremony, there was an audible gasp around the table that we objected to that, because that's something nobody objects to. That's the spiritual binding force of the Moose Harder, is Moose Heart. And I did mention that this is a grand place. Really, if you've ever had a chance to visit there, I have never seen anything like this. Every member of the Moose has the guarantee that if something happens to him and his wife, to the parents, that their children will be taken in by Moose Heart and raised through college and given a college education. They have a tremendous grade school and high school there, and they will also sponsor the child through college. If the man dies, there's a chance that the woman could be taken on as a house mother. The dormitories, if you would call them in, are little clusters of bungalows, each one with a mother living in it with the children. And brothers and sisters are not separated. It's a little family. And tremendous. They showed me an outboard motor there. It was a Johnson outboard motor that they had purchased. And the one next to it that the high school boys built in the machine shop. And they were identical. They had machined the gears, the tool, retooled the whole thing. It was identical. They had just taken the specifications and built one there. These are high school kids. I mean, they're training them for vocations, the print shop. It's just unbelievable. It's one of the greatest places in the world. So I can see why there's a definite appeal to people with children to get into this organization. And then, of course, there's Moose Haven, to which any aged moose can go in Florida. It's an old folks' home that is within the financial reach of people and maintained by the moose. So the objection is to the religious significance of the order. If they would become like the Kiwanis, the Rotary, the Optimists, and any of the civic service groups, we would have no problem. It's the religious pronouncements. And it's always that question, can a Christian in good conscience subscribe? Can a Christian make this identity? Particularly since he's not interested in it anyway. Now, there are other areas. I'll just run through some of these, and then maybe we'll have some time for discussion. Just go till 1:30, or 2 o'clock. Oh, then we wouldn't have much time. One of them is that the Lutheran Church does not stand alone. I think this should be made known of. The three major Lutheran synods, through a statement by Lacusa, did join together in a statement concerning objections to the lodges. Both principles and criteria, they never did get into application, though, of that. The Roman Catholic Church just recently lifted its ban on Masons, but leaving it up to the local diocese of how far they want to carry it. The Orthodox Presbyterian, Reformed Presbyterian, Church of the Nazarene, Church of God, Pentecostal Holiness, United Brethren in Christ, Mennonite General Conference, Free Methodist, Wesleyan Methodist, Assembly of God, Romanian Orthodox, all have positions similar to that of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Others are very close. The Church of the Brethren, Dutch Reformed, Ukrainian Orthodox, Syrian Orthodox, United Presbyterian Church of North America, until it entered into fellowship with the Presbyterian Church in the USA. Then there are other bodies that have much the same concerns, but we don't join together with them in the objection. The Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, Salvation Army, and the Mormons all have similar positions to the Missouri Synod. Also the Quakers, but on a different basis. Their position is strictly on oaths. The Quakers don't take oaths. There's been political opposition to Freemasonry in the past. There's a book put out by Alphonse Sirza called Anti-Masonry, which is supposed to collect, and this is where the spirit shows up again, it's supposed to collect all the reasons why people have opposed Masonry. It's a thick book put out by the Missouri Lodge of Research, and in that he doesn't touch upon the reasons we object to it. He doesn't understand them. He's got Missouri Synod literature. He's reprinted some Missouri Synod tracts in full, but he simply can't understand why anyone would be excited about confessing Jesus Christ alone. And so he sees no valid objection, and he says the Missouri Synod is mostly objects to Masonry because the Scottish Rite is against parochial schools. The Missouri Synod has a lot of parochial schools, therefore they object to Masonry. See, the Scottish Rite would like legislation. They've worked for years for legislation to compel every child to go to a public school. They haven't gotten very far with it, but this has been one of their goals. So you're dealing with such a different spirit. We have this booklet, which if you give me your name and address on a slip of paper, I will send to you, the Christians and their affiliations. It goes into all the different kinds of orders. We supply these to the fourth year men at the seminary every year. They get it automatically. But it is on the scriptural imperatives, the general concerns about lodges, initiating social memberships, other Christians besides Lutherans, the many different kinds of movements there are. There's a section on the new religions, and Christian confession and undivided witness, how the those of you that are acquainted with them, the mission affirmation, or the evangelism affirmations that were adopted by convention, how they speak to this lodge question, although they never mention it. So there's a study on that. And then finally, the services that's rendered by our office. So there's 8 sections to it, and I didn't bring them for distribution because they're in the print shop right now where we've exhausted our supply. And but if you want to give me, if you're not a fourth year man, and give me your slip of paper, I will see that you get it. And it will go much further than what I've said here. I've only tried to give you a smattering. I was thinking this went up till 2:30, but I guess it was only this morning. It was an hour and a half, wasn't it? So is there some area of this that you'd want to make a comment on or ask a question in a few remaining minutes? Okay?
I'm not sure if this ties in exactly, but what is our position on national social fraternities and sororities in colleges and universities?
There are approximately 900 of these. We have the complete rituals on 12 of the 900. We have found some of these highly objectionable with quasi-sacramental services. We have found others with no objections at all. But we're not going to create a problem over the few that we do have objections to simply because it wouldn't be fair. We happen to get their rituals, so we're opposed to them, but there's 800 others we don't have, so we're not opposed to them. That would be a poor tactic. So what we have done instead is produced a study called A Concerned Christian Looks at Campus Fraternities and Sororities. It's about a 25-page study of what the person should look for, what the questions are that they should ask before they make their final decision whether to join or not. And we've tried to come up with general guidelines simply because of the multiplicity of them. Some of them, there have been some changes, by the way, also in some of these by suggestions of our church. Some of these groups are very cooperative. We even had one group in Kansas City, the ones who founded Beta Sigma Phi, no, not the fraternity, the other one, Phi, Beta Sigma Phi. This adult women's group, they were going to start a new organization for older women whose children have left home. And they drew up a complete ritual in typewritten form and sent it to us and asked us if we would check through it to see if we had anything, found anything objectionable in it. Because they said, we truly believe that your church is representative of the concerns of other Christians too. And if there's anything that would be offensive to Christians in here, before we go into print, we'd like to know it. And just here or there, we marked little areas and they were glad to change them. So they're very, very cooperative. They said, it's not our goal to make religious pronouncements. But then on the other hand, there's others that we've asked even to sit down and talk to them. They said, we'd appreciate it if you'd mind your own business. We have one letter to that effect from a women's group. Okay, anything else? All right.
Do you have any problems with VFW or organizations of that sort?
Yes and no. There are some things in some of the rituals that we would object to, particularly in the VFW Auxiliary and in the long-form American Legion. However, these groups, too, sat down with our church before they were formed. Some of them, like the American Legion, and or like the VFW, sat down with some of the profs from the seminary before they were formed, and so they drew up two rituals. And every person is offered their choice of which ritual under which they want to be initiated. And at that time, it was accepted by the church body. So with the American Legion, there's a totally non-religious ritual, and so also with the VFW. And if our people request this, simply by saying, I have my own church, therefore I'd like the non-religious ritual, I'm in sympathy with your goals otherwise, this is permitted. And there's no problem. The only problem is most of our people don't pay attention to it and use the religious ritual for initiation, which they don't pay attention to either. But actually, in all cases, the religious ritual is much longer than the non-religious. So nearly all of these groups, because they have to go through this thing over and over again, prefer to use the non-religious. And that's their standard form, is the non-religious one. And they'll only use the religious one if somebody requests it, because it's so much longer. You know, that must be something in the Masonic Lodge, if somebody would attend regularly, to go through this whole initiation every time somebody joins. And if you're not acquainted with it, by all means, we can help you get a hold of a copy of the Masonic initiation. If you don't know what it's about, you ought to read it. It's reenacting the building of Solomon's Temple. And it is quite interesting. Okay.
Are the meetings scriptural? I mean, from biblical.
Depends on who you read. If you read some Masonic historians, they tell you that the first Masonic secrets were imparted to Adam in the Garden of Eden. And that Jesus and John the Baptist and Isaiah and everybody else were Masons. If you read a really legitimate Masonic historian, you'll say it started in 1717 with the trade unions in England. If you ask a Mormon of the Utah Church, the Latter-day Saints, he'll tell you that they have the original ritual from Solomon's Temple, and the Masons have a corrupted farm. If you ask a Mason, what about this priesthood and all that in the Masonic Temple, which has the same oaths, by the way, exactly the same oaths, the degrees of priesthood in the Masonic, or in the Mormon Temple. What about that? They say, we have the original, they have a corrupted farm. Joseph Smith joined the Masons before he wrote the ritual. Therefore, they have the corrupted farm. So the Masons say, we take men of all faiths. This is not true. In Utah, the Masonic Lodge will not allow a Mormon to join. And the Mormon Church will not accept a Mason in the membership. Because they do the same things identically in their ritual. Yeah?
If the lodges are fulfilling for many people the role of the church and making them secure in their, at least that they think they have salvation, should we as a church support the lodges in any way, support their hospitals, maybe when they come around to other people in the neighborhood? What kind of a role
Okay. Do
they do to the church?
Yeah. That, first of all, you've touched on the real danger, the greatest danger that the lodges pose. The question was asked about that people feel they have found religion. That is always the worst thing about false religion, is that it gives people security. They don't look further. They believe they have it. And here they haven't even met Christ yet, but they believe they have it. And it prevents them from being reached. That's the worst feature. The second question was whether we as a church should support lodge projects and so on. In our church, where I'm a member, during a vacancy, a family called, a doctor called actually, and asked if I would come out to the hospital. A baby was just born with no arms and with the bone between the hip and the knee missing in one leg, just flesh there. And he wanted to break the news to the mother. She didn't know it yet, whether I'd be out there to be with her. This doctor, meanwhile, called the Shriners Hospital and made arrangements for this newborn baby for years to come. They knew the family couldn't afford it. For years to come to receive care. And he could tell the mother, when he told her about the child, he could also tell her about the treatment and everything that would be done for the child all at the same time, see? This little girl's now third grade or something. She walks well. She has artificial arms. She doesn't even know that she was missing arms. I mean, she turns pages and everything, you know. She learned with these. And the Shriners have done a tremendous job. So the question is asked, the same question, different form. How can we condemn Freemasonry on the one hand and still avail ourselves, our people, of the Shriners Hospital? And I think the answer there is twofold. One, all charitable institutions do this. They go beyond people of their own faith, the Lutheran Hospital too, and many others. Our World Relief Program and so on doesn't only minister to Lutherans. It ministers to the people whose faith we oppose, Spiritists and everything else. The other is, who built and supports the Shriners Hospital? The Shriners should be given full credit for the idea, for the structure where you must be unable to afford it and so on, but who pays for it? Approximately a little over 1 million Shriners could not support 22 modern hospitals in the United States and a number of Burns Institutes that have budgets running into hundreds of millions of dollars each. See, the Shriners can't support them. Who pays the bills? The people who attend the shrine circuses? The people who attend the East-West football game? The people who attend in many communities, one local high school game a year that is dedicated to the Shriners Hospitals. Many colleges play one game for the Shriners Hospitals. The businessmen around town who are not Shriners, who make large charitable gifts for the support of those hospitals. That's where the support comes from. I am only guessing, but I would guess 90% of the cost of the Shriners Hospital is borne by the community. Willingly, happily, voluntarily, often in return for services rendered, like at a circus. But I think this, too, points to the fact that the community then has the right to benefit from the hospitals that it has built and supported with its funds. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I have a great deal of regard for the Shriners Hospitals, mostly because of this one little girl, but I've seen other things there. They're great. Beautiful idea.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay.